You're listening to the On-Call Nightmares podcast, and every week I bring you conversations with technologists who've spent time on call. This week, I speak to Nick Maludi from Encore Technologies, and one of the things that I really wanted to get done with this podcast was to talk to people who've been in really different situations. I know with Pumala, we got an opportunity to talk about someone who was dealing with being in a family situation and being extremely on call. This time we talked to Nick Maludi, who spent some time as a DoD contractor at a place called Silver Block Systems. And what's really great about the conversation we have is that Nick got to see some really weird on-prem. And when I say weird on-prem, I mean sticking a data center inside the back of a 737 and having to create networking, monitoring, and actually build the protocols that will send information back and forth to the systems. This is pretty nuts to me, and I have to be honest, I had no clue that this was the kind of conversation I was going to have when Nick introduced it to me. So I really am very thankful I got some time with Nick. And speaking of time, I'm going to be running short on time next week. I'm going to be in Sweden. I may not have an episode. If perchance you're listening sometime either on Thursday or Friday and you really would like to be on next week's podcast, you know, I may have some time for you over the weekend. I'm flying to the Ignite Tour for Microsoft. We're doing an event in Stockholm. It's free if you are in the Stockholm area. Check out the website. You can just Google for Ignite Tour Stockholm. I'll be doing a talk on performing migrations, and I'm really looking forward to it because I've never been to Sweden, and I'm a big death metal fan. So I'm going to go looking for maybe some, some different band t-shirts, maybe see if I can go see some music while I'm there. I'm a big At the Gates fan, so I would love it if somehow or another I find a good At the Gates shirt while I'm there. Anyhow, what the heck was that? Anyway, I'm not going to edit that out because it was weird. And today's theme is kind of weird on-prem, so we're going to get into the interview in just a second. I just got back from DevOps Days Houston, and I just wanted to send a shout out to everyone who was part of that particular event. I thought it was really great. I got an opportunity to talk. I did some conversations in open spaces with people. The DevOps Days community just is incredible. I'm very, very proud to be part of it. So if you have a local DevOps Days, I recommend you go check those out. Anyhow, if you'd like to be on the podcast, the best way for you to get in touch with me is to send me an email. It is oncallnightmares@gmail.com. Once again, oncallnightmares@gmail.com. You can also find me on Twitter @oncallnightmare or @jdestro. So let's get into our interview with Nick. Welcome back to the On-Call Nightmares podcast. And every week, I bring you a conversation with a technologist who spent some time on call. And this week, I am proud to introduce to you Nick Maludi from Encore Technologies. Nick's been a manager of DevOps team and the director. Recently, he was promoted to the director of engineering at Encore Technologies. He's helping people bring software engineering rigor to the automation and operations teams, I believe is what you're trying to do.
Yep. Yeah, that's pretty right. I grew up and did my traditional training as a software engineer in computer science and got hired on at this job because I've done a lot of practical work in the computer science field and realized that the industry is kind of going towards this DevOps model and software engineering is kind of core to that. And sure. So my boss brought me in to help take my experiences there and apply it to what we're doing in managed services.
But a big portion of what we're going to kind of have a chat about today, Nick, is your time that you did some work with the Department of Defense as a contractor. So you're working in the civilian sector now, but prior you were working mostly in defense and in military. Is that right?
Yeah. So let's see. It's probably 8 years ago now. I just graduated school and was lucky enough to get hooked up with a startup coming up right out of school. We did DoD contracting for the Navy. Mm-hmm. And really, we were building this integration platform for an aircraft. We had all these different sensors that the Navy wanted to test out. And we were rapidly testing new sensors, determining if they worked, trying to figure out how to operationalize all of these things. Mm-hmm. And really, what we ended up building was this like full stack integration platform to quickly talk to these sensors, to get the data, display it to the user, make decisions about it, integrate it with another sensor's output, that sort of thing.
Sure. So let's way back up a little bit, since we've got kind of an idea of what you've done and some of the places you've done it. You got started at a school at the University of Toledo, where you did a bunch in computer science and engineering. It looks like you worked in electronic medical records, and so you already had some previous experience managing production systems after school before going into doing defense work, correct?
Yeah, so during school, I worked for four semesters at a company called ABB. We did industrial automation. So mm-hmm. think of like control systems for big plastics factories or pharmaceutical factories or oil and gas, that type of stuff.
Gotcha.
And so we had like large distributed systems with a lot of concurrency and messaging and high throughput and that sort of stuff. And so I kind of got my taste or appetite for high performance computing there. And it's funny, during school, I thought I wanted to go into security because I liked the math and stuff behind cryptography. And and then after doing the kind of high performance computing side of it and taking some operating systems classes and kind of getting into the more of the practical side, I realized that's where I wanted to focus my time. And I just happened to get hooked up with a friend of a friend from ABB. And that's where I started going into the DoD contracting space. And really a lot of what we focused on was similar sort of things, but just like a much crazier scale, right? We're doing things for real and taking that, those concurrency and distributed systems models to a much, much higher level.
Gotcha. So when would you say you first took your steps in on call in your career?
So I did a little bit of work at the electronic medical records company, but it was mostly, we were on call. We only had about 10 doctor's offices that were customers of ours. And so, but we'd get called in and mostly it was like customer interfacing. So I'd go and help debug a problem at the customer site or something like that. And so that's kind of my start into it, but it was never off hours. It was always, you know, 9 to 5 kind of help.
Gotcha.
And then really it was when I started working for the DoD, and on call is kind of an interesting, thing there. You know, during the kind of winter months, we would be R&Ding and developing these new technologies. And then in the springtime, we'd go down and be doing test flights, and I'd be flying on the aircraft, actively debugging, fixing, problems on the, during the flights while we're running these sensors, developing new features if needed. And then we'd also take that those lessons we'd learn and that technology and then go and deploy it into the field and actually run real missions with it. And again, on the aircraft.
So I'm guessing we're not talking about a monitoring stack that includes like Nagios and PagerDuty. We're probably talking about some far more intricate systems to alert you with, correct?
Yeah, and it wasn't even so looking at what I do now and understanding how things like Nagios or Prometheus, all that work, we didn't really have any of that. A lot of it was homegrown. So
gotcha.
You can think of what we had as just like a data center on a plane. And so it was a small number of systems. You know, I think we had at the time our stack ran on like about 20 nodes, and I knew exactly what was running on every one of those nodes, and they never would really move. You know, there's
and
no.
Was it all Linux based, or was it different types?
All Linux based. It was I think CentOS at the time we were running. And
so that's cool. At least we know that there's some open source on our giant flying planes.
Yeah, actually a lot of stuff we did was open source. I'd say most of it. With things we wrote couldn't be open sourced, unfortunately. But we did a lot of open source. We worked with things like Qt and Postgres and all that fun stuff. So
awesome. Yeah. So as you know, by the time we get through the intro on the podcast, since you've mentioned to me prior we listening or recording, you mentioned you've listened before, we get to the rules. And I hope you're prepared for the rules. I know they're pretty tough. But the rules are don't incriminate yourself because I don't want you to get in any trouble, especially the fact that you work in the DOD sector. Do not incriminate others because every retrospective really should be blameless. And more than anything, help us learn. So with that, I'm going to allow you to give me an interesting story that you might have had from on-call. Why don't you share with us?
All right. So I think the first one I wanted to start with, and we can get into a couple depending on how long we want to take this, but the first one we were working on, so our stack that we wrote was really full stack, right? So we wrote things from network protocol, interaction with sensors. So I'd be writing custom TCP protocol handlers and communication interfaces to talk to a brand new sensor, taking that and transforming that into messages and saving it to a database.
Protocols, you're not just moving things like using existing protocols. You're actually having to build protocols yourself.
Right, exactly. It wasn't like we had like gRPC or something or HTTP like REST APIs. It was all custom, you know, bit number one is an enable flag and bit number two is the version flag and stuff like
now,
that.
Now, before you get too far into that, is this due to the methodologies that they require so it will, I guess, interact with the systems that are already part of the plane?
So not really. It was mostly, you know, we would take some vendor's technology, and these are like DoD vendors, or another contractor's technology that have like custom built their own little special snowflake, right, in the corner, and they say, hey, we have this cool capability, and we'd say, oh, we need that capability, and we'll try to integrate it in. And so every one of those different vendors had some unique protocol to communicate with it. And gotcha. So we had to quickly, the reason I called it an integration platform is we have to quickly integrate these new systems and grab the data off of them and be able to communicate back to send them commands to do what we wanted them to do.
You know, it's funny, and I know it's strange, and we'll let you get back into your story in a second, but I think about how automobiles now have become platforms for technology. When you look at them, it kind of almost reminds me of the same thing. There are all these ways that you could integrate other technologies into automobiles. And like I was in a Toyota recently, and I saw Apple Car, and I just thought about how more and more we're integrating services that we were traditionally putting on web servers and stuff like that. Now they're in cars, planes, you name it.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's funny too. I see a lot of parallels between the work that I was doing for the DoD and the stuff that I'm doing kind of in the DevOps, you know, systems operation space. Those integration points are always the trickiest and the hardest and the most painful. And I think as an industry, we need to do a better job of making those pieces talk to each other better and defining better standards and building technologies around those interfaces.
Sure. So let's get into a incident or a nightmare, if you will.
Yeah. So we got a kind of full stack of what we're working on. To give you kind of a visualization of how the plane was laid out, we had a couple server racks in the back that held all of our gear that did our data processing and gathering. Mm-hmm. And then imagine on like a 737, all the seats taken out, and on one half of the plane, facing all the windows, were these workstations. And the workstation was a big metal honking desk. And inside the desk was a monitor that was embedded into it. And then there was a tray in front of you with a keyboard and mouse, and then your chair that you'd sit there. And so, you know, on the left side of our plane would be four or five workstations all put up right against the wall, and network cables going all through the ceiling and everything. And so we'd fly around and we'd be working at these workstations and gathering sensor data. And some of the data that we'd gather would, we'd process it and it would render images on the screen. And so the images would then tell us, you know, do we see something out in the environment that is interesting or not interesting or something we need to go investigate? Mm-hmm. And so we're flying around one night in the middle of the night on a mission. And we've got everybody kind of working. We're in the groove. You know, I've popped a couple Red Bulls at this point. It's probably like 2 or 3 in the morning. And I'm sitting in the back workstation, which is on the opposite wing, kind of separate from everybody else, so I could focus on my tasks, which were debugging and troubleshooting and implementing new features. And all of a sudden, I hear over the radio. So we all had headsets on, these big, nice Bose sound canceling headsets. Mm-hmm. I hear over the radio, "Oh crap, my workstation froze. I can't do anything." And then I heard another report, "Mine's frozen too. I can't see anything at all. I can't do my work." And so I run up, take my headset off, run up there. I told them, "Hey, show me what's going on." They showed me, and everything was just frozen.
So here's the live on call, if you will.
Yeah.
Nightmare happening. And the difference is you're not getting the phone call while you're in bed. You're on a friggin' plane.
Right. I'm on a plane. We're at, 10,000 feet. It's the middle of the night. And stuff's broken, and we're trying to execute a mission. And I am the only one on the plane that's able to fix it, right? Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of pressure, right? This is like super high pressure scenario. And so I get back there, and our application was written in C++. And so I took one of the displays, I booted it up, I attached GDB to it, and tried to find out where it was hanging. And so I come in, and I block on the call, and I see, oh, it's when it was pulling these images that it wasn't getting a response in time. And so the display was hanging up, right? Like I said, we were full stack kind of engineering. These displays were written in C++, and we used OpenGL and like 3D graphics rendering to render all of this data kind of overlaid on the screen. Mm-hmm. And so the rendering loop was breaking on this RPC call to go and get the images from our data processing service on another node. And so I'm like, crap. So something, maybe the service is dead. And so I go over to the box that's doing the data processing. I'm debugging it. I see it's working, but it's just going totally batshit crazy. And I get on and start using my debugging tools, checking system stats, all this sort of stuff. See that the CPU is super high, but it's actually processing data. And so I'm trying to think to myself, why is this thing, it looks like the thing's doing work. I see the requests coming in and going out. Why are these displays freezing? And so I'm going down my kind of checklist, right? The data's flowing. The machine's actually working. I'm not out of disk or anything like that. And it kind of dawns on me at one point. I said, hey, maybe the network is just getting slammed for some reason, right? We have at this point, we had like six or seven displays open, and they're all rendering these gigantic images at different zoom levels and stuff like that. Maybe that is what's causing it. And so of course I open up like IFTOP, and I see on the tick marks of these images we had generated every several seconds, kind of on a big burst. And all the displays, when that tick would happen, would request new images for this updated data set. And when that happened the next time, I saw this huge spike in network traffic. And kind of as I thought, the network interface leaving the device was 100% saturated, and the packets were just getting dropped on the floor.
So is this satellite internet service that you're pushing?
So this was data going across the LAN, just within the plane itself.
The internal network that you have. So, okay. Yeah. So you're having to build racks within this machine, this airplane, you're having to ensure that there's network connectivity between the racks. You're then having to also troubleshoot the actual application in the racks.
Yeah.
Sounds like a lot of work.
Yeah. And actually, so it's funny. We built our own servers out of Supermicro pizza boxes from we were doing this, I think, 2008, 2009. So kind of before the Supermicro hype got big. Yeah. And, I was my own network guy. I was my own IT guy. We luckily had a team that helped us install stuff. And if the install guys are out there, Ken, Matt, Dave, you guys are rock stars, man. I love you guys. Miss you guys. Go ahead. Sorry.
No problem. So you really have to kind of, I suppose, be what you would call a polyglot, if you will, because you're not only having to deal with just technology that we're used to in the world of
tech now related to systems and servers and applications, but you also are having to deal with the idea of putting it on a plane.
Right.
Were there anything that you can recall about like electricity and power, like limitations that you ran into, and any of that ever come up in an incident where, you know, you had to figure out how to keep things going?
Yeah, there's a couple different pieces there, and I'll unpack that a little bit. So on the power side, the engines generate power in DC, okay, and all the servers consume it in AC. And so we had a point in time a couple of years in where we were putting more and more gear on the plane, and there was not enough AC power being generated from the converters that were built into the plane that we had to install our own converters to convert DC to AC in the bottom of these racks. And so that was part of it. We had to distribute our gear within the racks in evenly weighted. So we couldn't just put in like, you know, our SAN or our NAS in the same physical rack as our data gear because it was too heavy, right? So we had to distribute our stuff that way. And even heat was another concern. So we'd have cooling in certain areas and not other areas. And so certain boxes, because of the gear inside of them, ran hotter. So we had to move that stuff around.
Gotcha.
And actually, so a good environmental story that we had. We were deployed and we were flying around on a mission. And part of the mission parameters would be to go and find something. And then when we found it, we would need close up images and data from this target that we were going after. And so we'd be flying around to high altitude trying to look for something. And when we'd find it, we'd go down to low altitude, like 500 feet, and go get real close up images of the thing. And so we had found a target and we were going and descending, went down to 500 feet. We're flying around. And probably about 15 or 20 minutes in, the system just started acting funny. You know, things started to not appear where they should have. Things started to become slow. And all of a sudden, everybody's display just went out, right? No data was being passed at all. And so I get up out of my seat. I knew something was really wrong. I get up out of my seat and run over and start trying to figure out what had happened, plugging my laptop physically into the backs of these servers to see if the servers are actually responding. They were. Well, it turns out that one of our network switches in this cabinet that was adjacent to our servers that everything plugged into is kind of our central hub had overheated and had melted down. And so I had to go and rewire some of these network cables to bypass the switch kind of on the fly so that the data could get passed efficiently. And it actually become sort of like getting passed again, right, to bypass this failed node.
So let me ask you another question. Have there been missions that you went on in the past, or I should say that you were, say, rear with the gear and having to assist, almost like a, you know, you're on the ground, there's an issue, and then you have to kind of assist a team remotely. Have you ever been in that position as well?
Yeah. So initially when I started, it was me and one other software engineer, and I was the only one flight qualified to go fly on the plane. But as we went further along, we had another engineer that got flight. We hired a new guy and he got flight qualified so he could ease some of the kind of on-call burden for me. And yeah, he would go fly around and I'd be sitting there. We used IRC to chat to each other. And so we'd be talking on IRC. Back and forth. And so he'd be up there trying to debug some code, potentially it was something that I wrote or something that he had never seen before and he'd need help. And so I'd try to like SSH into a box, but we were over SATCOM to get network connectivity. Mm-hmm. And so the connections were always very spotty. When the aircraft would turn hard enough, the antennas on the top of the plane couldn't gimbal to point at the satellites like they needed to. Gotcha. And so every time the aircraft would turn, you would lose network connectivity. And so you'd be sitting there SSH into something trying to run a command and boom, your session would time out. And then it wouldn't establish until the satellite would go and re-gimbal and lock back on. And so that could take potentially several minutes.
So were a lot of the things that you had protocols for, were they kind of like almost stateless where, you know, things are moving, you're just hoping that they get to the end? Like are you doing things over UDP type of protocols?
Yeah, it was a lot of UDP. Yeah, it was a lot of like streaming data, a lot of real time information. So these would be like, we had things like cameras and other RF sensors that would be just streaming us data as fast as possible. Our mm-hmm. We had actually two networks on the plane. Almost, I can make an analogy to what I've seen in kind of managed services space as like an iSCSI or like a fiber channel network. Mm-hmm. So similar to how you distribute the management network in a data center to the data network or the fiber channel network on your SANs, we had a similar network that was our isolated high throughput data network for our high throughput sensors that would stream all of the data over. And then we had a separate network and separate network gear that would then be for our message passing and our control system and stuff like that. To one, just have enough bandwidth to pass that data through, and then to mm-hmm. isolate kind of those failures. So the data could still come over and not congest the network for all of our control pieces.
Gotcha. So here's another question. How large was the average mission team that went in the air with you most of the time, and then your support crew on the ground? Like how big a team per mission would you talk about?
Oh, that's a good question. So on the aircraft, we could hold 16 people total. Mm-hmm. And let's see, if we were doing a full flight profile mission, there would be 3 pilots, 2 flight engineers, a navigator, and then a mission commander. Mm-hmm. And then the rest of us would be, they called us scientists or project specialists at the time. And so most of us were kind of nerds and engineers. And then we had kind of a minimal viable crew to go and fly and operate the aircraft on the Navy side. And then on the ground, our support personnel were pretty light. We ran a pretty light project. And so there might be 1 or 2 individuals from the different sensor teams that were sitting there communicating with us. So I'd say no more than 6-8 people on the ground kind of helping us out. We had more than that, but usually it was pretty light during missions and activity. So,
gotcha. So, what are some things that you think you really learned mostly about having to support these types of incidents in real time on an airplane? Like, what's the thing that you really took from that? And then we're going to talk about like what you want to advise others to do. But I'm more curious about just like. What were the big things that you as an individual, as a technologist, and I'm not even talking about like individual technologies because it's obvious you had to support some of that stuff, but like as a person, what did you really gain, you think, from being part of that?
Wow. I gained a lot of, I guess, tenacity and inner drive. You had to be mm-hmm. super motivated and agile while you're up there, right? If something breaks, usually stuff came kind of in waves. And so one mm-hmm. thing would break and then 10 other things would break. And you had to adapt really quickly and kind of persevere through that. And so you need to be really personally strong to take things on the chin, right? So all of your gear is breaking, right? It's all of the stuff that we were working on that was broken all the time. And we needed to, you know, accept that and be empathetic to the end user that was having the problem. Say, you know, sorry, we'll work on getting that fixed for you. And then also be able to keep like that mental checklist and then prioritize quickly and knock those pieces off as you.
You know, it's not that far off, I guess, than from what we talk about when we're talking about managed services or anything like that, you know, in modern application support. You know, people need to be dedicated, I suppose, is the best way I can put it. Yeah. And that dedication is often visible in on-call incidents because you can see people who really do appreciate and care about ensuring the things that they're responsible for are maintained and stay online. And I'd imagine that being in an airplane makes it a little bit even more interesting to do because – let's face it, the ability to quickly do things like, let me just Google that answer or call Bob real quick. You know what I mean? Or let me call Jane real quick. Like, they're not the simplest things that you can do. You have to, I guess, be a bit more on the fly.
Yeah. Yeah. And that brings up a pretty good point too. So I couldn't rely on things like Google. So I didn't have access to like simple things like documentation, or if I did, I would have to be smart about it and download it ahead of time and put it on my laptop. Being able to call Bob. If I was going to call Bob, I had to use this sat phone that sounded like you were talking through a tin can in a windstorm on a 1972 landline, right? It was terrible. And you're having to fight engine noise and electronic feedback and all this stuff. So you had to do a lot of understanding and troubleshooting yourself. And so I got really, really good at understanding the way that the system worked and the way the software and the hardware was working together. And you had to constantly ask yourself, you know, how is this working under the hood? What is the way the system is actually interacting? And then being able to troubleshoot that yourself. And that's something that I see missing a lot in other people that we hired on after I worked there, and also just other engineers that I've worked with. That's something that I think is undervalued as a skill, is being able to debug, troubleshoot, and understand systems quickly. Mm-hmm. And it helps you become a better engineer and a better support person when you kind of develop and hone those skills, because it applies to more than just software, right? Or being on call, right? It actually helps you become a better troubleshooter and problem solver in your life.
Makes a ton of sense to me. So let's go back to the future now. Let's talk about now. So we talked a little bit for a second, but why don't you tell me about what you're doing at Encore lately?
Yeah, so Encore is a managed service provider. We do a bunch of different things, but our group is really focused on helping large enterprises get better at their IT. Mm-hmm. So we'll come in and do an evaluation, talk to them about what their weak points are, and help them develop a plan to implement whatever it might be, right? Whatever our gaps that we found are. So it usually involves a lot of automation. Mm-hmm. It involves a lot of social transformation, and I guess it's the DevOps transformation, kind of cliche. But it's really deeper than that. Our goal from a business unit perspective is to help other businesses do their business better. And that's really the root of it, right? Like, DevOps is just kind of a means to an end, and mm-hmm. the end is helping them achieve success, right? Whether sure. that's, you know, improving their speed of delivery or improving their reliability or whatever that is, so that they can deliver their services better to their customers. Makes and so, so we,
makes a lot
we,
of sense to me.
Yeah. So we do a lot of things around, like I said, automation. We're doing our own DevOps transformation. So I recently got promoted to be the director of engineering, mm-hmm. and I'm now the manager of my old team along with a new operations team. And so we're going through our own DevOps transformation to bring those operations people into the DevOps fold and teach them new skills. And so my role is a lot less technical nowadays, but I think it's just as important, if not more important, because I now I have a whole bunch of people relying on me, not just a small few.
Well, then you have given me now the ability to ask you two of the questions that I like to ask as we hit toward the end of the podcast. And one of these questions are specifically for managers. If you could tell another manager that's managing a team that's on call a piece of advice, what would you give that manager?
I would tell them to really understand how their system is working and how to delegate appropriately. So I feel bad sometimes, and I've experienced this a little bit in my management career, where certain individuals will, you know, see, you know, they'll get a call in the middle of the night, and we run a pretty diverse shop. So we manage things from network to compute into the application layer a little bit. And, you know, we'll get a call in the middle of the night, and a storage person will be on call, and they'll just immediately try to delegate over to the network team because the customer says it's a network issue, without having to debug themselves. Mm-hmm. And so I think that the managers could do a better job of understanding what the real problems are and how to do some simple debugging and help delegate and get the right people on the phone if they need to.
Makes sense to me. And so let's also say to the person who's on call right now, who, you know, maybe new at it, or maybe they've been doing it for a while, what's a piece of advice you'll give to the person who's currently on call?
I think a big piece of it is make sure you're happy with what you're doing and you're at an organization that appreciates your hard effort, because being on call is not easy. I struggled with it. I think it's a really undervalued skill and responsibility. I think people sometimes, you know, it can be a burden also, right? You're having to stay home nights and weekends and make sure you're available and having to give up time with your family. If you're an organization that doesn't value that skill or doesn't listen to those issues or problems or try to work with you, it's time for you to find a new job, right? Don't be scared to change, because being somewhere that your skills and your pieces of value are taken to heart is really important.
Gotcha. Well, let's let everybody know how they can get in touch with you if they'd like to keep talking. You're on Twitter, correct?
Yeah. I think the best place to find me is on Twitter at Nick Maluti. I'm sure it'll be in the show notes.
Yep, it absolutely will. And if they want to check out, you also have a tech blog for Encore. I'm going to keep that in the show notes as well. It's encoretechnologies.github.io. Nick, thanks so much for, you know, just another take on this kind of work. I really do appreciate it, and I hope you enjoyed, you know, talking with me about it.
Awesome. Yeah, Jay, this has been awesome. Thanks a lot for taking the time today.
No problem. So everybody stick around. We're going to wrap up the podcast, and we'll be part of me begging you to be on, just like I did with Nick. So stay tuned. We'll be right back.
I wasn't kidding you when I said weird on-prem, was I? I mean, it sounds pretty weird to me, but it was awesome. And if you are doing some weird on-prem also, I'd love to talk to you as well. Get in touch with me. I mentioned it before, but it's at jdestro, at oncallnightmare, and also oncallnightmares@gmail.com. Get in touch with me one of those ways. I'd love to talk to you about being on call with some weird on-prem. Anyhow, that's it for this week. Like I said, if you've got some time, please let me know if you'd like to be on the podcast, because I am short for next week an interview, but, you know, hey. Make sure you've listened to all the previous episodes, and don't miss out, because some really great stuff in some of those conversations. So thank you very much, everyone, for listening. As always, it's super appreciated. I get some really great feedback from people when I'm on the road or just via online. So thanks again. We'll catch you next time on the On Call Nightmares podcast, where every week I bring you conversations with technologists who've spent time on call.